History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to do something about it. Take a little initiative, ask a few questions, invest some time in listening, and you never know how much long-buried memories might just take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. Buckle up for today's program because we're going to hear an incredible story of survival that unfolded off the coast of Vietnam almost 60 years ago. 85-year-old Michael Bush of Henderson, Nevada is our guest today. But before we hear about those most harrowing moments, let's go back to the beginning. Can you tell us about your childhood a little?
I grew up in Chicago, Illinois, and when I was probably 5 or 6 years old, we moved to Palos Heights, Illinois. And then when I was about 10 years old, we moved to Orland Park, Illinois. When I became old enough and through eighth grade and went to high school, the only way to get to high school, my father would drive us and we would thumb our way back, and that didn't sit well at all with my parents. So we then moved to the city of Chicago, south side of Chicago, about 3 blocks from Leo High School, and that's where I went, was Leo High School.
And you had a couple brothers. Where did you fit into that order?
Yeah, I was number two. I had an older brother and a younger brother. We all three went to Leo High School. My older brother went to Marquette College, and I went to John Carroll University in Ohio.
And we're going to talk about what you were doing during the Vietnam War and how amazing it is that you're alive to sit here talking to us. But I'm curious if you have any memories as a kid, you know, toward the end of World War II, were you aware of what was going on, and did anything register with your young mind in those years?
The only thing I knew of, I was collecting gum wrappers at home. My mother told me to save the tin foil from the wrappers, and I asked why, and she said that will go to the military for something or other. I don't know. I was too young to know. That's all I know of World War II.
But they probably had a parade on your birthday every year.
They did. My birthday was November 11th, Armistice Day, and my mother said I was born at 11 a.m. when the bells were ringing.
And funny thing, they still have parades on your birthday all these years later.
They celebrate my birthday. I like to think that anyway.
Well, there's plenty to celebrate and be thankful for with regard to your service to our country. But you mentioned going to college at John Carroll University outside of Cleveland. Was there any thought in your mind about military service at that time?
Not really, but everybody was in the ROTC program their first 2 years. Third year and fourth year were voluntary. I volunteered because they said they had an aviation program, and there were probably 100 of us that applied to the school. And by the time you finish the physical and the written exam, we were down to 6. And I was fortunate enough to be one of the 6 chosen to do the flight school. They sent us to Chagrin Falls, Ohio, where we got fixed-wing training, and I ended up eventually getting a private pilot license. When I graduated from college, the colonel called me into his office, and I thought, uh-oh, what did I do wrong now? And he said, you are number two in the class, and therefore I can offer you a commission in the regular Army. And I said, oh, what would that do for me? He said, you would be a second lieutenant, same as a West Point graduate. And I said, okay, I'll take it. So I took it, and then they told me, oh, by the way, before you go to flight school, you're going to have to spend 2 years in a combat arm. So I ended up going to Fort Knox, Kentucky, to take armor officer basic training. Then I went to Fort Irwin, California, to finish my 2 years. Upon completion of my 2 years, I was automatically sent to flight school at Fort Walters, Texas, in Mineral Wells, Texas. We started out with, I think it was 43 people in the class. As we went along, they washed out people. After successfully completing basic training, we were then transferred to Fort Rucker, Alabama, where we took utility training. And then those of us that successfully accomplished that mission, we then went to Cargo. We went to Cargo, and we ended up graduating, I think it was 6 or 7 people. And while we were going through training, it was late 63 into early 64, all of us who finished the course, our orders were changed to South Vietnam. So upon graduation, we automatically went directly to South Vietnam.
And about the same time, your younger brother is having a similar experience getting deployed over there?
Sometime within the following year, just before my crash, my younger brother was in the Navy. He was a crew chief in the Air Sea Rescue, a crew chief in a Jolly Green Giant. The Jolly Green Giant had a freak accident over a golf course in Japan. They threw a blade. And with a helicopter, when you throw a blade, you take on the characteristics of a rock, and there's nothing you can do except say, Lord, here I come. They crashed and burned, and everybody, it was a closed casket. Shortly after that is when we got shot down in Vietnam on a rescue mission. We had had an assault mission during the day, and they left 3 aircraft to serve as picking up dead and wounded. And that night, sure enough, the VC had attacked the unit that was in there. We were called on to pick up dead and wounded. On our first approach, we had to abort the takeoff, and I suggested that we go out over the ocean. We would receive less fire. We went out over the ocean. On our final approach, we got hit. We crashed and blew up.
And I want to ask you more about that, but I don't want to miss anything leading up to that. And let's, if you can, I mean, this is 60 years ago, so I know it's not easy to remember all these things. But when you found out you were heading to Vietnam, how did you feel about that?
Well, matter of fact, when my orders were changed to Vietnam, my mother just happened to call me and said, Michael, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to Vietnam. And she said, did you volunteer for Vietnam? I said, no, everybody's orders were changed from wherever we were going to go to Vietnam.
What did you understand about what you'd be doing over there and how that would work?
Didn't know a heck of a lot. I had successfully completed H-21, which is the tandem rotor cargo helicopter at the time. I had successfully completed that, so I knew I was going to go somewhere and fly the 21. And sure enough, they sent me to the battalion headquarters in Pleiku. And from a couple days in Pleiku, I, with one of my classmates, was transferred to Quy Nhon, which is right on the coast to South Vietnam. And we both were transferred to Quy Nhon, where we flew the H-21 cargo helicopter. We'd either fly supplies or troops into different areas, combat areas, or special forces camps areas.
And I imagine, you know, in those early months over there, you're probably starting to get a taste of what war's really like and probably seeing some things you'd never seen before.
Absolutely. Yes. It was late 63 into late 64. And little by little, the enemy action toward us increased. Originally, when I first got there, there was occasional shooting at us when we were either going into an area or coming out of an area. The longer we stayed, the more it became. Like in 64, there was pretty considerable shooting at us as we would go into an area and as we went out. The first assault mission I went on in a 21, we flew along the coast with a load of South Vietnamese soldiers. We hopped over a little mountain and started going into the area. And there were being bombed in the area, and there were tracers going in every direction. And my heart started pounding so hard, I thought my throat was going to explode. Luckily, there were two of us flying. They always had you fly with an experienced pilot, and when you were a new pilot, you learned how to fly. And as we were going in to land and let the troops out, I thought my throat was going to explode. My heart was pounding so hard. Seeing all the bombs hitting and all the tracers going in every direction really got your blood going.
Yeah, I imagine so. And I think you showed me a picture. Maybe it wasn't the same bird, but you said your very first flight in it, you had to make kind of a rough landing?
Yes. We only had gunships that were Hueys. The rest were 21s. Toward the middle, starting to get the end of 64, we started to fly Hueys. We went to Nha Trang, Vietnam, and flew with an instructor for a while. And then we had a solo flight. And wouldn't you know, on my first solo flight in a Huey, I had a tail rotor failure. Lucky, lucky me. I went into auto rotation, and as I was going down, I saw there was a small opening into the swamp where there was a sandbar. So I successfully crash-landed into the sandbar, called on the radio, did not recognize my voice to tell the base that I had gone down. They sent a large sky crane to pick our helicopter up and take it to some place to be repaired. When they picked it up, they brought a Huey in and picked me up and took me back to base.
Well, I'm sure that gave you a little perspective compared to what you normally did, where a lot of times guys are waiting for you to show up. You had to wait for someone else to show up,
yes,
huh?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was scary. And I was lucky. The Army did a great job training their helicopter pilots. We constantly had the instructor cut the engine off where we had to go into an escape landing. And that training paid off, because when I lost the tail rotor, I immediately went into auto rotation. Going down, I spied a little sand area inside the jungle, and I grabbed it and crash-landed successfully.
I think we can all agree that was a pretty close call. But the words close call don't even begin to describe what Michael Bush would survive in October 1964. It's time for our first break, but we'll dive into that incredible story when we come back. Find photos and a short video with Mr. Bush online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with 85-year-old Michael Bush of Henderson, Nevada, originally from Chicago, Illinois. He's going to be thinking about his family's Gold Star hero, his younger brother Jimmy, this Memorial Day, not to mention the friends he lost in Vietnam. But before we dive into the incredible ordeal he was the sole survivor of in October 1964, there's a pretty significant detail that I haven't mentioned yet. You head over there to Vietnam, but you're leaving behind in the States here someone who's pretty near and dear to your heart, who I just had the privilege of meeting here. So it's one thing if a single teenager gets sent over to Vietnam, but you're a married man over there, right?
Yes, I was married and had two small children at the time.
How much did that weigh on you on a daily basis, the fact that a wife and two kids are waiting back here hoping you come home?
Absolutely, it did. My mother even asked me, she said, "Michael, did you volunteer to go to Vietnam?" And I said, "Of course not." My orders were changed as I was going through flight school.
What was the date of when you were shot down?
It was October of 64.
I'm thinking of setting the context for this. So October 64, I mean, this is a day that really changes your life. I'm guessing, though, that before that, you'd probably had a few close calls where you almost got shot down?
Yes, we had. There wasn't a lot of advertising as to what was going on in Vietnam at that time. But by mid-64, we were encountering pretty heavy resistance when we would go into an area. They would shoot at us on the way in and on the way out. They got a lot of us. But the helicopter could sustain a lot of hits without going down. You'd hear the ping, ping as you were being hit.
And then when you get back to base, you count up the holes or what?
Oh, yeah. We take it back and they fix it up.
You know, you talk about this like it's no big deal. I know a lot of people listening are saying, wow, that would scare the you-know-what out of me. How did you handle that on a day-to-day basis, the inherent danger of what you were doing?
Well, we didn't like it, but we knew it was for the greater good because we were going in and picking up dead or wounded. We had gone to the Huey from the H-21, and the Chinook was soon to come in also. But when we went to the Huey, we knew basically our job was to go in to an area to pick up dead and wounded as quickly in and out as we could get, because the cross on the side of the helicopter appeared to be just what enticed the enemy to shoot at.
Yeah, there's a long history of that, where the whole point of the cross is to tell the enemy, don't shoot at this.
Yes.
But in just about every war I've heard of, it made people a target.
Yes, it absolutely did. They would use the cross as the target because it was in the middle of the helicopter.
And what was the unit that you were assigned to?
Well, the first one was the 8th Transportation Company out of Quy Nhon, Vietnam. That's when I was flying the H-21 cargo. We would fly either people or food, or in many instances in cages, chickens and pigs that would go either to Special Forces camps or South Vietnamese Army camps. When at that time, each outfit had two Hueys that were gunships that would provide cover for us when we were going in and out of an area. as the war went on, little by little, the 21s were replaced by the Bell Huey, which was a great, great helicopter.
You know, before we get to your incident that left you with the Purple Heart, so you're over there in Vietnam flying these missions every day, and that's where you find out that your brother's been killed. What was that like, and how did you process that?
Yes, I had heard from my parents that my younger brother had died. They were over a golf course in Japan doing training when they had a freak accident. The Jolly Green Giant threw a blade. That is absolute chaos. When you throw a blade in a helicopter, which is a freak accident, you take on the characteristics of a rock. And they were all killed and burned beyond recognition. That was hard to take. My younger brother was a good guy.
Yeah. And, I mean, this has been 60 years since this happened. Have there been times over those years where you've kind of daydreamed about what his life might have been like had he made it home from Vietnam?
Absolutely. I include my younger brother in my prayers every night. Jimmy was a good kid.
What can you tell us about who he was and what he was all about, the kind of things he was into?
Jimmy, as soon as he graduated from high school, chose to go into the Navy as a volunteer. He went into the Navy. He spent a couple of years going from location to location and then was given the opportunity of going to Japan to train in the Jolly Green Giant. He accepted that. When they did throw the blade, they crashed and burned. Everybody on the helicopter was killed, and they were all unrecognizable. So that was hard to take.
So you've got that as the context. You've got a wife and two kids at home, and you're continuing to fly these dangerous missions. So walk me through what happened the day you got shot down. What was the task, and how were you going about it?
We were flying out of Pleiku in Hueys. We had had an assault mission near Tuiwa that day along the coast where we had dropped off troops to go into combat. Most of the aircraft returned to either Pleiku or Quy Nhon. They assigned two or three Huey units, one of which was mine, to stay in that area overnight in case we had to go in to pick up dead and wounded. When we landed, I was the junior pilot. There was a captain who was the main pilot. I was the other pilot as a first lieutenant. We stopped to get gas, and a young man came to put gas in the helicopter, and he asked me, he said, "Sir, can I sometime get a ride with you?" And I said, "I'll see what I can do for you." That night, shortly after dinner, I was sitting in the movie theater in the base. We'd had an assault mission in near Quang Nai, Vietnam that day. There were aircraft from Pleiku and from Quy Nhon. We and one other helicopter crew were left near the landing zone in the local town to provide pickup of dead and wounded if they occurred that night. And sure enough, as soon as it got dark, the Viet Cong and NVA attacked the unit that was on the ground, and we were called to go in and pick up dead and wounded. I had not flown in Vietnam at night at that time, and flying there at night was chaos. It was almost impossible to see what was on the ground. The only thing we could see, the other pilot was older and a captain. I was a first lieutenant. He said, "No problem, I'm used to flying at night." So as we were flying, we started to fly toward the area that where the assault mission had been, and that was near Tuiwa, Vietnam, right on the coast. And it was dark, and in Vietnam at that time, if you flew at night, it was like closing your eyes and flying in a closet. As we approached the area where the troops were, I saw the tracers coming up in front of us. And I said, Captain, are those people shooting at us? He said, yes, those are tracers. I said, well, I haven't flown at night, and I've never seen tracers coming up at me at night. I guess that's why it surprised me. So we started to do an approach, and as we started to go down, the tracers increased. I suggested to Captain Allred that we do our final approach out over the South China Sea because we wouldn't be taking as much enemy action. He agreed. We started to go out over the South China Sea. As we turned onto our final approach, I heard the ping, ping, ping of the helicopter being hit. Captain Allred said something to me. I turned my head to look at him and say, what did you say? We hit the water and we exploded. The next thing I knew, I was in the cockpit, drowning. I quickly hit my quick release button and went straight up, forgetting that I might be in the cockpit. I had either been blown seat and all through the chin bubble, and when I took my seatbelt off, there was nothing between me and air except water, or the roof of the helicopter had been blown off, because I just hit my quick release and went straight up, and there was nothing between me and air but water. When I broke the surface of the water, I was about 5 feet from Captain Allred. He said, did Lieutenant Bush get out? I said, I'm out. He said, are you hurt? And I said, well, I've got some cuts. I can feel the burn from the water. He said, I think I broke my leg. Well, as it turns out, his left leg was broken half, and the left side of his chest had been crushed. The ribs had pierced his lungs. They told me he probably would have died. Well, as he told me that and asked me that question, behind me, one of the crewmen was crying for help. So I turned around, left Allred, and started swimming toward the person to help. As I got to the person, he grabbed me, and we both went underwater. I fought my way free. We came up to the top, and I yelled, don't grab me, I will help you. He grabbed me again. We went underwater again. I fought my way free again. When I popped up, he was gone. I turned around to look for Allred, and Allred was gone. I could not find our crew chief and our gunner. They were nowhere to be found. So I realized by now that I better get out of there. I tried to get my boots off by holding my breath and going underwater and trying to unlace them. And I tried 4 or 5 times to do it. I finally got one boot off. I couldn't get the other one off. Then I realized I didn't know which way to swim toward the shore because it was pitch black. And all of a sudden, the sky started to light up. The Air Force dropping flares looking for us. I noticed as the flares were dropped, I spun around, looked around, and saw off quite a bit in the distance were the mountains. So I knew that was the way I had to go. With the one boot on, I got rid of my flak jacket and my web equipment, which was my .45 and my survival knife. I tried to get as much off me as I could to aid in the ability to swim. I started swimming toward the mountains that I could see from the flares the Air Force were dropping. I would be swimming along, and all of a sudden, a wave would be 10 or 15 feet over my head. It would knock me down and tumble me in the water, and I'd fight my way back to the top. After that happening 2 or 3 times, I realized I could do that to my benefit because just before the wave hit, I would be sucked back a little bit. So as soon as I felt myself being sucked back, I started swimming as hard as I could forward, knowing the wave would tumble me ahead towards the shore. And that worked. As I would go under. I would fight my way back up. I would say, God, please give me one more minute. Then I'd feel myself sliding back, and I'd start swimming as hard as I could, and the wave would knock me forward and spin me upside down. And I did that successfully for quite a while. And eventually, lucky for me, the wave went out and my booted foot was standing on a sandbar. And I panicked. I tried to run and it was no use. As soon as I left the sandbar, there was nothing but water under my feet again. But the waves were so big and high, they were coming 10 feet over my head. They would knock me down. I'd fight my way up and say, God, please give me one more minute. The next wave would come, knock me down and drag me, push me further toward the beach. Eventually, they knocked me down and went out, and I realized I was laying on the beach, face down, thankfully. I think I puked up half the South China Sea. I then thought, okay, after all that went on, I got to get out of here because I know the bad guys are going to be looking for me.
Which means perhaps the most miraculous element of his story is still to come. How did Michael Bush avoid becoming a prisoner of war? Hear it from him when we come back. And don't forget to check out the photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We're also going to hear about the healing effect of his honor flight experience when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 85-year-old Michael Bush. Originally from Chicago, he lives now in Henderson, Nevada with his wife of 64 years, Diane. But the fact that she did not become a young widow raising two children alone in October 1964 is pretty amazing when you consider the story Michael told us about his helicopter being shot down 3/4 of a mile off the coast of Vietnam. We heard how he somehow made it to shore in the middle of the night, the sole survivor from that helicopter. But when we left off, he was battered, bruised, and bloodied on the beach, but knew the enemy would be looking for him.
They're seeing all the flares dropping. They heard all the helicopters up here. So I went up the beach as far as I could to where it started to go up into the mountains, and I dug myself a shallow grave, and I buried everything except my face. And of course, I was covered with blood, and the mosquitoes just ate me alive. But fortunately, I stayed like that, and sure enough, in the middle of the night, a group of probably 5 or 6 feet long, walked maybe 10 yards away from me, walking down the beach looking for survivors from the crash. And thank God they didn't see me. So I just laid there all night long, knowing that come first light, there would be helicopters everywhere. And sure enough, the next morning, shortly after first light, there must have been 100 helicopters flying in the area. I got out real quick, crawled my way to the street, and got up and was just starting to run toward the helicopter when one of the guys ran and picked me up, took me back, threw me in the helicopter. We went up and we went straight to the 8th Field Hospital in Nha Trang. They put me in the 8th Field Hospital there. I was there for, I think, about 7 days. They checked my back had been injured, and I had numerous cuts all over my face and legs and arms. They stitched me up, put me in the hospital there, and then they sent me to the States. There was a special forces flight that was going to the States. They sent me to the States to a hospital in Texas, where I spent probably another 10 days. Then I went home to my home in Illinois, to my parents' home, spent about a week there with my wife and my parents. I spent a week there, and the whole week was in bed. At the end of that time, I went back, got to California, and then flew hopscotch from California. Air Force aircraft island hopped, Guam, Wake, Philippines, and eventually Saigon. I got into Saigon, and I got a flight back to Pleiku from Saigon. And that's pretty much my story.
So you went back to fly on the same kind of missions with the same unit?
I went back, and they assigned me to the headquarters there to be the assistant S4. All of the cargo, food, ammunition, etc. I spent the remainder of my time, I would fly on occasional assault missions, and most of my time was spent on the ground the remaining couple months I had left at the end of 64.
Well, and I think everybody who just heard you describe the events of that night are saying, he actually went back and flew again? How in the world did he live through that night, first of all? And I've got to ask you, I mean, that has to have been the longest night of your life, right?
Oh, yeah. It was chaos, utter chaos. When I made it out of the helicopter, later the Seabees found the helicopter. It was 3/4 of a mile out in 75 or 85 feet of water. And they said there was nothing left of the helicopter. It had blown up when it hit the water. So I don't know if I was blown through the chin bubble or the roof had been blown off. When I became aware of what was going on, I was sitting strapped in my seat, drowning. I hit the quick release and didn't think of anything. I hit the quick release and went straight up, and there was nothing between me and air except water. So somehow, I managed to swim that 3/4 of a mile at night in the middle of the ocean. And that's an area that we had flown over many times during the day, and it was shark-infested waters. And thank God they weren't out that night.
I mean, there's so many elements of this story that say, how in the world did this happen? But just so we understand all the details, somehow, some way, you survived, but everyone else on that helicopter didn't. How many others were aboard?
Four others. They eventually found all four. And what was left of the helicopter, and the CB said, there's no use in trying to salvage anything. It's been totally destroyed.
So
they did eventually find the other four.
Which I'm sure meant the world to their families. And,
oh, yeah.
And those four names are on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall, I would guess.
Yes, they are.
And we'll talk about when you got to go to the wall. But So you get shot down, your helicopter blows up, you come to in the water, get to the surface, somehow swim and have the waves toss you all the way to shore. You're wounded all over your body. You hide yourself in the sand except for your head, getting eaten alive by mosquitoes. Meanwhile, all these wounds that you have, and you have to sit through a whole night not knowing if friendly forces are going to find you or you're going to be captured. And I'm sure you know now some of the prisoner of war stories that have emerged from guys that were captured around that same time. I mean, they were prisoners for 7-8 years in some cases.
I was very, very lucky.
That whole night, what's going through your mind while you're sitting there or you're, you know, holding in that spot?
Fear. Nothing but fear and pain. And I knew if I could live till morning, there would be people, our people, looking for me. And sure enough, first light, there were probably 100 helicopters in the air looking.
And I'm sorry for all these questions, because everybody listening, you know, nobody's been through something like this. So you're the only one that can explain this to us. Are you thinking about your wife and your kids? Are you,
Matt? Absolutely. In the water, we had 2 kids at the time. And in the water, every time the wave would tumble me, I would plead with God and say, please, God, let me live a little longer. I don't want my kids to grow up fatherless. And I would say, please, God, one more minute. And I one more minute myself till I got there. And like I say, when I hit the sandbar with my booted foot, I panicked and I tried to run. And I couldn't run in water up to my neck. And the waves just beat the crap out of me. And eventually I hit the beach face first, luckily, because I then started throwing up half the South China Sea. And when I was done vomiting, I looked to get as close away as I could. And sure enough, I saw the guys walk by me in the middle of the night. I didn't move. I held my breath, and they walked right by me. There were about 5 or 6 of them.
That had to be the scariest moment of your life right there.
I don't believe it. I think I probably watered the sand a little bit.
I think we could all understand why. But then, this is also just 2 months after your brother's been killed. So you're probably thinking about the rest of your family, too, and a mother who just lost a son?
No, I didn't know at that time. I didn't know that Jimmy had been killed. I didn't find that out until I was given time to recuperate, and I chose Illinois so I could see my wife and my parents. And my parents said my younger brother had been killed in this freak accident. And I said, my God, what would have happened if I was killed? You would have lost 2 of your 3 sons in a period of a couple months. That would have been pretty hard, I'm sure. After being a parent, I think it would have been devastating to have 2 of your sons killed.
Well, I guess I have to just ask you the obvious question here, because you just told us a story that nobody else can tell us, and certainly nobody listening has lived through anything like that. How do you explain it? How do you explain your survival against all those things that could have ended your life?
I really don't understand how I did survive. I was very lucky. I had been a swimmer in high school and college, and I'm sure my time when I was in Quinyan, I would swim in the ocean when I had free time. So I guess because I was a good swimmer and I pleaded with God to save me, I got saved somehow or another. I think I was an above average swimmer. That and pleading with God got me in somehow or another. I still to this day thank God every night for saving my life in Vietnam.
And we can understand why. And so, you know, you just told us your path back home. So you get back to Illinois and you see Diane again. What was that moment like?
Going to heaven on earth. Unfortunately, I was in such shape I couldn't go beyond giving her a hug and a kiss. I wasn't able to do what I had in mind. Too many injuries. I made up for it later.
And everyone knows what you're talking about. But you go from that heavenly moment of being reunited with your wife and your kids.
And I had to go back.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. Emotionally, how hard was that to go back to something that almost just killed you?
Yes, it was very, very difficult. Going back was very difficult, but I was a regular Army officer, and the military said, you're going back, and I had to go back. I didn't have any choice. So I flew space available on Air Force from California through the islands like Wake and Guam and the Philippines to Saigon, and from Saigon, I hopped on one of our aircraft right directly back to Pleiku. And then at Pleiku, they made me the assistant S4, where most of it was office-type duty. There was some flying, but nowhere near what I would have been flying if I'd been back in the unit.
Well, and if there's anything else that is important to you about your time over there, feel free to share. I don't want to cut you short, but I'm wondering what it felt like when you finally got word that you're going to get to come back home from Vietnam and your tour was done.
That was what everybody looked forward to.
What was it like when you came home? And how were you treated when you came home?
Not well. When we would go through the airports there, we tried to not be in uniform, because if you went through an airport in uniform, people threw things at you and screamed at you and yelled, baby killer, baby killer. That was very, very difficult for military people to do at that time. When you went through an airport, people were very anti-military. And thank God, when I had the honor flight, it was exactly the opposite. When we went through the airports going to and from Washington, the people acted like it was a great, great party, and they were cheering and screaming, and little kids would run up to us. It wiped out the chaos that we were greeted with when we came back from Vietnam. Thank God.
Well, I'm so glad you shared that, because I know, you know, here in the Las Vegas area with Honor Flight Southern Nevada, I know what you shared is exactly why Belinda Morse and her team do this. And I want to ask you more about it. But for all of us who are involved in Honor Flight anywhere, that's the reason. That's the why. And I'm just thinking, everyone that's been listening to your story, they heard that you lost your brother. You came about as close as anybody can possibly come to losing your own life and leaving your wife a widow and your kids fatherless. And these people are yelling at you and calling you names to the point you can't even wear your uniform. That just had to fry your brain to try to soak that in.
It was very, very difficult. I don't know why it happened the way it did, but you tried to avoid wearing a uniform in an airport because people just were calling us baby killers and screaming at us. Now it's exactly the opposite. On the honor flight, people are screaming and cheering and clapping, and little kids are running up and giving you hugs. It lessened the chaos and the sad feelings from earlier. It revived you. It was great.
That's really powerful, and I'm sure that there were moments on that trip that stand out as well, with some of the places you went in D.C. and the experiences you had. Is there an experience, a moment or two, that really stood out to you on the honor flight?
Well, the honor flight itself, when we go through the airports, was really just wonderful. The receptions were warm and loving, and we got to see some great things. The walls that we saw in Washington, and looking at areas of Washington, were just incredible. It was a great flight. And the people that ran it were really fine, fine people.
You gave us such a powerful picture of the healing nature of your honor flight and the contrasting experience 60 years almost after you came home from Vietnam. There are some veterans who say, you know, I don't need to go on the flight, or I don't know if I could handle it. Would you have any words for them based on your own experience?
Anybody that is offered the honor flight would be foolish not to accept it. The honor flight is a great, great experience, and I would strongly recommend it. Anybody that is offered the honor flight, I strongly suggest you take it. The people that conduct the honor flight are marvelous, wonderful people that are there to help you in any way they can. It's wonderful.
Well, and I don't want to leave anything out. I definitely don't want to forget to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a story that nobody else could tell us. Is there something that, when you think back about that time in our history, is there something you think the rest of us need to understand about what you and so many others were doing and why it still matters?
Well, I feel like I should have done it. I was a member of the United States military, and the United States military at that time was trying to help South Vietnam. And it's like my mother asked me if I volunteered. I said, no, Mom, I didn't volunteer, but I'm a member of the United States military, and the United States military says we need you in Vietnam. So I go. I have no regrets. They asked me, and I was a member, and I did it. And I'm not sorry I did it. I would have preferred that Vietnam hadn't happened, but it did, and I swore an oath to the United States, and when they called on me to do my duty, I did it. And my brother Jimmy, he swore an oath. Jimmy did, and he died, you know, for his country. I'm sorry to see that he died, but I'm proud of him that he died in service to his country. Yep, I'm proud of being a member of the United States military. Very proud of that.
And I just have one more question. If there's anything you want to add, feel free. And I may be reaching here. I don't know. Coming so close to losing your life in October of 1964, did that change the way you lived after that, the father, the husband that you were?
I just think I'm grateful that the Lord saved me. And I'm grateful that I got to see my kids all grow up. If I hadn't done that, I'd be dead, so I wouldn't have anything to feel. But I thank the Lord every night that he gave me a great family, and he allowed me to live through it.
And aren't we thankful for that today? Thanks again to Michael Bush and his wife, Diane, and also to Belinda Morse of Honor Flight Southern Nevada for connecting me to Mr. Bush and his remarkable story. If you ever have the privilege of meeting him, make sure you ask him how he came to play golf with the late, great Arnold Palmer. We're out of time on the radio today, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.